This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today in The Exchange, a closer look at a well-loved substance that's derailed many a well-intentioned New Year's resolution, sugar. It's our ongoing Science Cafe series in partnership with David Brooks of the Science Cafe Nashua. At the most recent cafe, a couple of weeks ago, participants dug into the science of sugar, and this hour we'll cover many of the same topics from that conversation, ranging from sugar's chemical structure to its reputation as addictive. The panelists also discuss the well-known role sugar plays in weight gain, as well as diseases like diabetes. But it's not all negative. Human bodies actually need a certain amount of sugar to survive, and some types of sugar might not be quite as bad as others. Today in The Exchange, we dive into the sugar bowl and examine the science of the sweet stuff, and let's hear from you. What are your questions about the effects of sugar on metabolism? How about the impact of refined versus raw versus artificial sweetener? And by the way, do you feel addicted to sugar? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Stephanie Ballantyne, nurse practitioner at St. Joseph Hospital in Nashua. And Stephanie, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Dr. Bert Matheson, naturopathic doctor, registered dietitian, and certified diabetes educator. And Dr. Matheson, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for letting me be here.
Also with us, Gail Carey, professor of nutritional science at UNH. And Professor Carey, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Laura.
And also with us, as always, David Brooks, science writer at the Telegraph of Nashua and moderator, as I said, of the Science Cafe in Nashua. And David, thanks and welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, I want to start with you, David. As I said, a couple weeks ago, you looked at this at the Science Cafe. Why sugar? How sweet was your conversation?
It was bittersweet at times.
I bet.
Science Cafe, the two founders, Sarah Eck and Dan Marchek, and I, we get together occasionally and talk about possible topics. And sugar was kind of an obvious one. It's perfect for Science Cafe because there's lots of science about it, lots of nutrition, which is in many ways, I think, the most complicated of all the sciences. And yet there's also a lot of public interest in it, which isn't always the case. So we said, well, we'll just talk about sugar. And we got actually these three panelists. It's great that all of them could come to the radio as well. And we were packed. We meet at Killarney's Irish Pub in Nashua, have for a while. And good thing the fire marshal wasn't there because we were overflowing into the halls.
Really?
Yeah, in the halls.
Amazing.
So it was good. So everybody's very interested in this topic.
And, well, what was the sort of emotional state that people brought to this? I mean, people feel very passionate about this.
They do, and they're all confused. I think that was the easiest way to say it, is that, you know, we all love our donuts, and they really don't want to be told you can't have sugar. On the other hand, they've also heard that sugar, you know, does horrible things to you and kills your liver and makes your children insane and is all a plot from some rich people somewhere else. So they had lots of questions that ranged from the biochemical to the very the practical, the pragmatic.
Well, we'll dive into all of that today. And again, it's the Science Cafe on The Exchange. We're taking a spoonful of sugar and looking at the science of the sweet stuff this hour. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Donut eaters or not, all calls and comments are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. So let's dive into the science a little bit. And Professor Carey, what is sugar? What falls under that heading besides the white stuff on the teaspoon that we're all familiar with?
Well, Laura, sugar is really a umbrella term that describes a lot of things that you can see on listed on food labels, from evaporated corn syrup to maltose to dextrose to high fructose corn syrup to glucose. But biochemically, when we talk about sugar, what we're really referring to, or what your body is interested in, is a molecule called glucose. It's a very simple molecule. It's 6 carbons in size. And the body actually requires glucose for many of its tissues, particularly your brain and your red blood cells, need glucose in order to survive. When somebody talks about sugar, they could be talking about a myriad of food substances. As far as the body's concerned, it's glucose that it's interested in.
Well, and I read yesterday that sugar is a carbohydrate. Is that right?
That's correct.
Professor Carey? I thought carbohydrates was, you know, breads and pasta.
Yeah. Carbohydrate, again, is a wide term. And under that umbrella, so carbohydrate simply broken down means carbon that's hydrated. So it's carbon with H2O attached to it in various formations. And carbohydrates can be found as what are called simple carbohydrates versus complex carbohydrates. Simple would be the 6 carbon molecule of glucose, maybe hooked together with another glucose molecule or another monosaccharide called fructose. But complex carbohydrates are molecules that are hooked together in big, long chains, so you may have hundreds and hundreds of them hooked together. That's what you find in pasta, whereas table sugar is sucrose, which is simply glucose and fructose hooked together.
It's a very simple form.
Correct.
Did human beings, you mentioned we need glucose to survive. I mean, how did sugar play a role when humans were evolving? You know, I've read sort of that initially when we were hunter-gatherers, we really, really needed this.
So as far as we know, you know, the human brain has always required glucose. And there's glucose. Plants have complex carbohydrates in them predominantly. In some plants, like fruits, you can find more simple carbohydrates. But we've always needed glucose in the body. Your brain needs 120 grams of glucose a day to keep itself going, whether you're thinking or sleeping. And so evolutionarily, yeah, we have been hunter-gatherers, but we've gotten enough carbohydrates from our food sources, or if we don't, our body makes it.
So here's the big question, and I'm going to start with you, Dr. Matheson, put you on the spot a little bit. Is sugar bad for you?
Well, that's a good question. I believe we're omnivores, you know, and that we can eat different food sources. And I don't believe sugar, you can make a blanket statement that it's bad for you. As such, it really becomes a matter of balance. So, no, I don't really believe that it's bad for you as such.
How out of balance do you think most Americans are when it comes to sugar?
I think we're pretty out of balance in it. You know, it depends what you're eating. If you're eating a lot of refined sugars, then I would say that kind of sugar is bad for you. But as the professor was saying, there are many different types of carbohydrates, and they're all digested differently, and they're digested more slowly or more quickly. And so it's very hard to make a blanket statement that all sugar is bad for you. Although refined kind, I would say that's not good for you.
So if I came to you and said, I'm getting all my sugars from apples and pears, you would say, great, no problem.
Well, I'd want to look at the rest of your diet as
sure.
well. So, I'd prefer to see people getting sugars from fruits because they're wrapped in fiber and they have other phytochemicals in them that are very helpful to the body. So, yes, I'd rather see them doing that even than fruit juice. I'd rather see it still in the fruit.
Stephanie, you know I'm going to ask you the same question. I know it's not an easy one, but what would you say if I came to you and said, hey, Stephanie, you're my nurse practitioner. What should I do? Is sugar bad for me?
Well, no. I think, as has already been said, I think sugar is vital for us. I think it's just a matter of too much and maybe of not the right kinds of sugars. Moderation in diet is what we traditionally recommend. I think that we're all so busy nowadays, people tend to resort to faster foods or processed foods, foods that are already prepared for them. And commercially speaking, a lot of them are very high in the sugars because it tends to taste better to most people.
Some nutritionists and scientists, researchers, Robert Lustig comes to mind with his big 2009 manifesto. Others have called sugar, you know, toxic, evil. I mean, what do you think? Are we over-demonizing sugar, Stephanie?
I don't think we're over-demonizing it. I think we're not doing a very good job of informing people and educating people as far as diet choices. I see a lot of people who come and they're confused and they're unsure of what their diets really should be. I spend a lot of time trying to explain things. I think if people understand how their bodies work and what their bodies need to work, they're much more likely to seek it out.
It seems like in the 90s, Dr. Matheson, that, you know, fat was the culprit and there was all this focus. And then I remember there were low-fat foods, which actually turned out to be really sweet. You take a bite of them and go, wow, this is super sweet. How come? Well, they were trying to compensate for the lost fat. I mean, are we sort of in danger of just picking on one particular substance here, you know?
Yeah, I think we're always in danger of that. Definitely. I was trained in the 80s as a registered dietitian, and fat was definitely
the enemy. You
remember
that? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Fat, cholesterol, boo, terrible.
Definitely. And then as I worked in through the 90s, things started to shift a little bit, and people started talking about more the paleo style of eating, and I tend more in that direction for the general population. And I think it's definitely a matter of balance. We do tend to – we want to simplify things, and we want things to be black and white. People like that, you know, but unfortunately we can't really do that with nutrition, and everybody's different biochemically. It's very hard to generalize about nutrition.
All right. Well, I definitely want to ask all of you about the biochemical effects of sugar on the body, on the brain. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And David Brooks, what sort of came up at your Science Cafe about the effects on the body, first of all? What were some of the themes that came up, besides the obvious that, you know, sugar can make you fat?
Sugar can actually, you know, that didn't come up very much. Not very many people talked about weight, maybe because it was so obvious they didn't bother. There was a lot of questions about the liver and about subtle biological stuff that we laymen don't quite understand. That there's this feeling out there that sugar, particularly refined sugar, which is a term that kind of carries this mysterious aura of badness, that can do things to the liver that for reasons we really don't understand. And we actually discussed that a reasonable amount when we weren't talking about diets, which did come up quite a bit. So
go ahead. Yeah.
And that was really it. There is a feeling that things are happening internally that are very complicated that people need help with, and sugar is one of the things you latch onto. You can say yes or no about sugar.
Okay. We'll look at that after a break. The liver, the heart, also possible connections between sugar and cancer, all that coming up, plus your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the Science Cafe takes a spoonful of sugar. We're examining the impact of the sweet stuff on our brains and bodies. That was the subject of a recent Science Cafe Nashua with David Brooks. We're following up on that conversation with David and a panel of guests. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your questions and comments this hour about the science of sugar. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to our listeners now. And William's calling from Franklin. Hi, William. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Go ahead.
I have very poor teeth. And I've noticed early in time when my teeth start to go bad that cane sugar, our table sugar, would cause toothaches, but I found quickly that honey does not cause toothaches. I've sadly learned since then that honey is actually worse for the teeth than cane sugar because it's sticky. Well, anyways, for about 15 years now, I've been using always honey, never cane sugar. When I cook and bake, whatever I'm making that needs sugar, I put honey. And I use about 5 pounds of honey over a 3-week period. Now, I know no sweetener is really a health food, but Am I asking for trouble eating all this honey?
William, it's a great question, one I had anyway. I'm not sure who wants to take that. Are some types of sweeteners, I'll turn to you, Dr. Matheson, I guess, honey and maple syrup, for example, often cited as examples of if you have to sweeten it, these are better.
Sure. Well, there are definitely things in honey that don't appear in cane sugar, and it would vary between types of honey. Honey's been used for a long time actually on wounds and does help them heal topically, interestingly. But in terms of ingesting honey, you can pretty much think of it as a refined sugar. It's just refined by the bees, you know. So it's very accessible to your body, just as cane sugar would be. So
it's not better, quote unquote.
I don't think biochemically it's better for you in terms of what it does to your blood sugar response. And that's kind of the core of health is what does the sugar do to your blood sugar response? Does it raise it quickly or more slowly? And honey, yeah, maybe a little bit more slowly than cane sugar, but not a significant difference as far as I'm aware.
What do you think, Professor Carey?
Well, just to add to what Dr. Matheson said, biochemically, the sugar part of it isn't any different. But honey, being so close to nature, may have other micronutrients in it that you wouldn't get from the very purified cane sugar. So it may have, you know, very low levels of selenium or different micronutrients that the body needs in very tiny quantities. And
somebody told me to take it as a source of B vitamins. I mean, I mean that, no pun intended, because it's made by bees. But have you heard that, Professor Carey?
I have not.
You have not. Yeah. What about maple syrup? That's a favorite sweetener here in the Granite State.
Right. Same idea. You know, the closer you are to nature for your carbohydrates, the better.
All right. Well, it's a great question, William. Thank you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's an email from Michelle in Manchester. She says, we hear a lot about sugar and how it can cause damage to the kidneys, but is there a connection between diseases like non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and excess sugar intake? What happens when sugar is processed through the liver? Stephanie, do you want to take that one? The impact
sure.
on the liver.
Sure. There most definitely is a connection between excess of any calories, particularly sugar, which is changed into triglycerides and then stored in the liver. We're seeing more and more of what we call fatty liver, non-alcoholic liver disease, which is projected to just burgeon in the coming decades. And it's primarily from lack of exercise, more calories basically in than you're expending.
So, wow. We're all used to hearing about diabetes and heart disease, but not until yesterday did I realize there was a connection between sugar and the liver.
It's quite huge because the triglycerides replace and push out the healthy liver tissue, and then just like an alcoholic cirrhosis, the liver tissue is no longer able to perform its function, which is multi. And vital for survival. And the liver will swell. Quite often I will have people come in complaining of upper quadrant pain. And when you ultrasound their livers, they're found to be quite full. And even in their 30s and 40s, we're
wow.
seeing it. Yeah.
When you say upper quadrant, what does that mean?
The right upper quadrant in the abdomen.
Wow. Okay. Did you want to jump in on that, Dr. Matheson? The connection with liver. That was new to me.
Yeah, that's a huge connection. It's really a problem. If you can burn off the sugars before your liver can convert them into triglycerides, i.e. in exercise, then that can help prevent NASH or non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. So that's the key exercise.
Well, and this is a big question I have, and maybe for all of you. If I ate a lot of sugar, but I also worked out faithfully, like you said, Dr. Matheson, and ate my brown rice and my whole grains and vegetables, I mean, am I necessarily going to get liver disease, diabetes? I mean, I guess the point I'm trying to make is it just the sugar that's to blame here, or is it a broader lifestyle? And I'd love to hear from everybody on this, but you first, Dr. Matheson.
Yeah, it's a broader lifestyle. Definitely for an athlete, they can get away with having some simple sugars, particularly right after a workout, because the muscles are crying out for sugar after a workout, and you want to store that as glycogen in the liver and the muscles. So, yes, that's where nutrition has to be individualized. An athlete sometimes could do with some simple sugars with good timing right after the workout.
So it's not fair to demonize just sugar.
It's really not. We
you
want
look at the
to,
whole picture. Yeah.
Yeah, we want to generalize in nutrition, but you really can't because everybody's biochemically different and their lifestyle is different. And some people have insulin sensitivity that's better than others, and they use their sugar better. Others not so good, and that could be genetic or lifestyle. So
interesting. I'd love to hear from you too, Professor Carey, on this. You know, if somebody, they have a lot of sugar, but they also have an otherwise excellent lifestyle, then is the sugar really a problem?
Right. So I think the more active you are, the more you can get away with that, in that your body is going to take it in, but then burn it right up, the less active you are. And it not just sugar, but if you're overeating fat, if you're overeating protein, your liver is very smart and takes those carbon molecules and converts them into fat. And so that's where the liver problems come in, is this overabundance of calories coming in, whether it's refined sugar, complex carbohydrates, even proteins will get converted into fat, and then the liver becomes overburdened.
Well, Michelle, thanks for the email. A couple more emails I want to share with you. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Today in the Exchange, our Science Cafe is taking a spoonful of sugar, looking at the science of sugar, the impact on the brain and the body. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from Jenny who says, what about stevia, an alternative to glucose derived from a plant? She also says, if dental health is a concern, would they say stevia is acceptable? I bet this came up at Science Cafe, Dave. You know, not just stevia, but good old-fashioned saccharin and NutraSweet and agave. There are all these alternatives to sugar.
Definitely talked about stevia. Actually, you know, we didn't get into NutraSweet very much, but there was no question about stevia. And I said, golly, let's hear from the experts.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, a lot of people do use these. And, you know, Stephanie, if somebody wants a Coke and they say, well, I'll have a Diet Coke instead, that's fine. Is it?
I say no.
Really?
Diet Coke, if you read the label, there's nothing in it but chemicals. It's not a food. It's a non-nutritional food product. There's some discussion now that diet foods are actually potentiating weight gain.
Can you explain that to me? Because I have heard that recently, and I know there were legions of people who love their Diet Cokes and Pepsis and who feel like it helps them from reaching for that candy bar.
Well, and I think it may. I don't know that it's a great replacement. I usually encourage them to switch to seltzer, flavored seltzers or carbonated waters. I think a lot of people have the diet drinks or the sodas to meet the pop of the, you know, the carbonation. The sweetness is, I think, an acquired taste. It's not really a sugary sweet, but it's a manufactured sweetness. There's been some discussion of it fooling the body and in anticipation of a rise in the blood sugar. And so an insulin secretion is stimulated from the pancreas.
Oh, even though you're not consuming sugar.
There's been that discussion. Yeah, some of the research suggests that. And then when you have a rise in the insulin levels, you're going to drop your blood sugar, which was never elevated in the first place, and then you're going to be hungry and shaky and then you'll seek more sugar. So you're putting yourself on a roller coaster.
Wow. I have a friend, someone I've been friends with since high school, who just loves diet soda, always has a big cooler of it in the house. She and her husband just, you know, drink many cans a day.
Yeah, she may want to try saving a can for about 3 to 6 months and then taste it and see what it tastes like.
I don't know.
It might be a way to come off it. Yeah.
What do we know, Professor Carey, about the science of these sugar alternatives? I'm really glad this person emailed about stevia.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research on a whole variety of these alternatives, the cyclamates, saccharin, and concern about, are they cancer-causing? Do they change people's appetite? Do they change brain biochemistry? the research is pretty vast, and some, you know, for example, Canada, I think, came out against cyclamates because they were carcinogenic.
What are cyclamates?
Cyclamates were sort of the forerunners of saccharin.
Oh.
So they were sweeteners at that time.
Because saccharin's been around for a long time.
And it's been around for a while, right. So each time these things come out, you know, there's a scurry to see, are there other effects on the body? I think, as Stephanie's pointed out, that, again, these are chemicals that people's bodies may react to differently. We don't know all there is, and we don't want to be part of a national experiment to find out. So better to choose something with fewer chemicals, particularly if you can't pronounce the names of the chemicals that are on your what you're consuming.
I'm getting a little worried because I drank a lot of Diet Pepsi earlier in my earlier in my youth. Go ahead, David.
Well, one of the things with it's the long term that's for you know, a layman like me makes it worrisome. Just reading up, preparing for today, I was looking at whether sugar is toxic, and it was talking about the possibility of chronic toxicity. And the studies said it was at least 1,000 meals had to be studied. Sort of was like sort of this break before you can start to say anything about chronic. And 1,000 meals is a lot of meals. That's a lot of time to keep track of people, and it's a lot of time to figure out what's going on. So it's why it's so hard to say yay or nay.
And as our guests have told us, right, David, that every body is different. You know, some bodies may just, you know, process this stuff better than
biology
others.
Biology is just it's just wicked hard. Physics is a whole lot easier because all the electrons are the same. But whereas everybody is different, I'd much rather stick with physics.
Well, thanks again for that email. Again, the email address exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. To you, Dr. Matheson, so we've sort of touched on this, but what happens in the body when regular old sugar comes in, never mind the substitutes that we just talked about, but regular old-fashioned sugar?
Well, your pancreas secretes insulin, and that's a good thing because that's how the sugar gets into your cells where it's used for energy. And not only sugar but also fat and protein is drawn into the cells as fuel and as building blocks. So that's what happens. But the problem becomes if we're consuming too much of the refined sugar, insulin is being secreted too much, and insulin's a storage hormone. So we store, and we store energy, and we gain weight. And this is where – and this starts a spiral of what's called insulin sensitivity. It's like if you sit on your wallet in your back pocket, after a while, you don't feel it anymore. You know, and that's
that's a good analogy.
What the body does. And it says we're just going to keep kicking out this insulin because it doesn't seem to be working. And insulin, again, causes you to gain weight if you have excessive insulin floating around in your bloodstream.
And that also probably leads to diabetes in some cases.
It does, exactly. The pancreas can essentially wear out after a while, and that's what we call type 2 diabetes.
So that's the insulin response when sugar enters our bodies. It affects the pancreas and, as we talked about earlier, affects the liver. What about the brain, those sort of pleasure centers in the brain when we eat something really yummy and sweet?
Sure, yeah. Carbohydrate is known to increase serotonin in the brain, so there is that response there, and that might be why I don't myself call it quite an addiction, but it could be splitting hairs. I mean, there's a brain chemical response in response to carbohydrate or especially simple sugars. So serotonin is, of course, what we try to enhance using SSRI medications.
It's what makes us psychologically feel good.
It does. It's one of the many neurochemicals that does that.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you think? Is sugar addictive, Stephanie? I mean, we use this term addictive a lot lately, but addictive, like nicotine, alcohol, is sugar addictive?
Well, I think, again, it depends on the individual biology. I think for some people, tobacco is addictive. Alcohol is addictive. Other people can smoke very rarely and not become nicotine addicts. So it can depend on the individual's receptors and their propensity to take up and to produce serotonin. So I wouldn't call it addictive per se, but I think that the SSRI analogy was a good one. I think perhaps if people are low in serotonin, they might have a greater propensity to seek out other substances that will produce the similar response.
I see. Boost those serotonin mm-hmm. levels either through sugar or drugs or, mm-hmm. or whatever. Do you want to comment on that too, Dr. Carey? Is sugar addictive?
Sure.
That's a strong word.
It is a strong word, and it does have to be carefully defined, but there's some very interesting work coming out of the University of Michigan as well as Yale University looking at this question and making the point that as you move away from food into more refined food. For example, grapes aren't addictive, but if you then ferment those grapes into wine and produce alcohol, that can become addictive. And so they're studying that whole notion, but not just about refined sugars, but in most processed foods, you find sugars and fat, right, refined and together, and that combination of refined sugars in combination with fat in all of our desserts and donuts and cakes and cupcakes and so forth, that may hit what the industry calls a bliss point, where people have a craving for it.
The industry, meaning the food industry.
Correct.
Yeah, and it does seem like there's sugar in everything. Tomato sauce, I mean, for pasta. Where else do you find sugar where you wouldn't expect it? Like, why is there sugar in here?
Oh, gosh. Peanut butter, which is amazing. I mean, you can buy peanut butter that's just ground up peanuts. But if you look at
the
label,
for it, though. Right.
You can find all kinds of sugar. Peanut butter, tomato sauce, spaghetti sauces, obviously, the usual, you know, dessert, all kinds of dessert products and food.
Yeah,
products.
Desserts you would expect it,
exactly.
But I'm always surprised to see it in peanut butter and spaghetti sauce. And
they're
so
developing
forth.
All these
in?
Cool yeah. euphemisms for sugar too, isn't like what was you gave one about, you know, dehydrated cane syrup or something.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
I mean, you know, oh, that's not sugar. It's natural.
When you do see on the labels too, David, you know, no high fructose corn syrup. And there might be 16 other sugars in there, but no high fructose
no
corn
high
syrup.
No high fructose corn syrup, exactly.
That's the bad guy of today's sugar, so to speak.
And it sort of is the bad guy, though, to a certain extent, because it's fructose and not glucose, as I understand. That's one of the big problems with it.
We'll talk about that after a break and take more of your calls, so stay on the line. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More on sugar on the Science Cafe in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, New York Times columnist Ron Lieber on his new book, The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Smart About Money. That's tomorrow morning at 9. Today in The Exchange, the Science Cafe returns with David Brooks. We're examining the science of sugar, and we'd love to hear from you. We're talking about the impact of sugar on our bodies and brains, including connections to diseases, not just diabetes or heart disease. The connections are pretty well known there, but problems with the liver, maybe even cancer. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. And Stephanie Ballantyne, Dr. Matheson, David Brooks, Professor Carey, let's go back to our listeners. Michelle's in Concord. Hi, Michelle. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, I apologize. I missed the first 10 minutes, so you may have covered this. But I did hear a world-renowned surgeon, pediatric surgeon, talking about how sugars or foods that are eaten by children translate into sugars, essential sugars of the body for brain development. And I just wondered if your panel could maybe elaborate on their thoughts on that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Michelle. And Dr. Matheson, we talked a little bit ago about the impact on the brain of anyone, but what about brain development of mm-hmm. kids? It's a good point.
Yeah, you know, that's definitely not my expertise, I'd have to admit there. Perhaps there'd be someone else
who would
like to speak
on
that.
Let's throw it to Professor Carey, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's something that I haven't heard of before. You know, certainly, as I've mentioned, that, you know, the brain requires sugar in order to generate the energy it needs to sense nerve impulses and so forth. But in terms of development, I would think there would be a whole host of nutrients that the brain would need, particularly essential fatty acids and amino acids in order to construct the protein and neurotransmitters that it needs. So I'm not aware of any research demonstrating a link between carbohydrate and brain development.
Although you would think that with most American kids getting too much sugar, not the amount that you talk about for proper brain development, that you know, there might be an impact there. Parents often think that sugar makes their kids hyper, right? The joke is, I gave your kid 5 cupcakes and then I'm sending them back home to you. So do we know anything about that?
About
sugar making kids hyper.
About making kids hyper. Yeah, there was a whole flurry of research looking at the link between sugar intake and ADHD or hyperactivity, and it's complex. I don't think the research came down on saying that sugar will make your kids hyper, that there may be, again, individual variations in this. It may be, as Dr. Matheson explained a little bit earlier, the relationship between taking in very refined sugar and having a spike of insulin and then a drop of insulin that can get you on this roller coaster.
The crash. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes, I've witnessed that on several Easters, and as Easter approaches now, I'm starting to rethink the whole Easter basket thing. But go ahead, David Brooks.
I have seen research in which there's a perception that it makes kids hyper, which is extremely strong, and that the study basically has parents watch their kids through a window and gives the kids fruit juice, and sometimes it's sweetened and sometimes it's not, and ask the parents to judge. And if you tell the parents we gave them sweetened fruit juice, they'll say, oh my gosh, look at the kids bouncing off the wall, even if they weren't given sweetened fruit juice. So it's a little hard to differentiate it.
All right. Well, oh, did you want to jump in, Stephanie?
Well, I wanted to add also that children are very clever and very perceptive, and they very often will meet your expectation. So if you have an expectation that they're going to be hyper the day after Halloween or Easter, then they usually will be.
All right. We'll leave it at that for now. Here's an email from Nancy. She says, what is the primary source of sugar in a typical U.S. diet? The tropical plant sugarcane, manufactured sugar, others? Nancy, good question. Thank you. Dr. Matheson, what's the primary source of sugar in the typical American diet? A lot of people may come to you and say, I don't eat that much sugar, and then it turns out maybe they do.
Sure. Well, I think a lot of people forget about the fluids that they consume. So probably a large source in many people's diet is sweetened liquids, like even fruit juice, soda. These are all very significant sources of refined carbohydrate. Fruit juices, although there are some nutrients in them, are refined. As you juice the fruit, you're taking out all the fiber that would blunt your blood sugar response. So fruit juices should be on their radar as a significant source of sugar in the diet.
It does seem like people consume a lot more Gatorade and Powerade and those types of aids, which are sort of marketed as, woo, this is healthy.
Right.
Is that a major source of sugar in the diet?
I think it is. You know, you get the energy drinks that will have a significant amount of sugar and caffeine and other things in it as well. And Gatorade, I guess, depending on the population, definitely in athletes, certainly.
I wonder about that, Dr. Carey. You know, Gatorade originally was for, you know, athletes who were working out really hard on a hot day. Now it seems to be sort of the standard drink given out to, you know, any kid on a soccer field.
Right, yeah, and the beverage of choice, absolutely. And I think that can be a big contributor. It's in lieu of a can of soda, you know, can have significant amount of carbohydrate in it. So having your kids drinking water would be a great alternative, and plenty of, you know, hydration for the soccer field.
Let's take another call. This is Chris in Kittery. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Good morning, Laura. Good morning, panel.
Morning.
I have a question and a comment to make. Question is, I'm type 2 diabetic, and I've tried all these different kinds of artificial sweeteners, and all of them in diet drinks, they taste terrible. Is there any sweetener, artificial sweetener, that actually tastes like sugar instead of leaving this awful aftertaste in your mouth? And also, my daughter is a CrossFit trainer, and she's very much into nutrition. She calls sugar the white death.
White death. And, wow.
And but she also, I mean, she loves, you know, a glass of nice cold orange juice on a summer's day or nice cold apple juice. And what she does, and I've actually tried this, and it works, and it's still tastes great, is cut it half and half with water.
Cut the apples.
You still get that great taste.
Yeah.
Or if you're with water and ice, put in some lemon juice or some lime juice, and it's incredibly refreshing.
Hey, thanks a lot for the call, Chris, and sorry to hear about your type 2 diabetes. So, Stephanie, he has to have alternative sugars if he wants something sweet. He can't have regular sugar.
Well, a diabetic can eat a normal diet. In fact, very often for weight loss, we will prescribe a what we call a diabetic diet. Again, it's just going back to the golden mean, the rule of moderation. They don't tolerate sugars as well as someone without diabetic condition, so they can't cheat. But they can certainly eat carbohydrates, and they have to trade off certain foods if they do want to have something that's been sweetened with a lot of sugar.
Well, go ahead.
It's best to avoid because they're going to elevate their blood sugars, which opens up a whole nother realm of problems for them.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Chris. And let's go next to Dennis in Barrington. Go ahead, Dennis. You're on the exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yes, I was calling because there was a comment made earlier regarding high fructose corn syrup. And the comment was that it was harmful because it contained fructose. You haven't followed up on that yet, but high fructose corn syrup has essentially the same combination of fructose and glucose that's present in sucrose, which is cane sugar, a common table sugar. So there's really nothing more harmful about high fructose corn syrup than regular sucrose.
You know, this is a good point, Dennis. Thank you. And Professor Carey, I turn to you first. I also came across this last night that while high fructose corn syrup has been demonized lately, I've had people pull me aside and say, you have to talk about this on your show because it's killing our kids, that it isn't that much worse or any worse at all than regular old-fashioned sugar. Can you enlighten us there?
Sure, Laura. You know, biochemically, the caller's correct. You know, high fructose corn syrup has fructose and glucose, the two monosaccharides that are present in table sugar. And the body, the liver, has enzymes to be able to metabolize that fructose and get that energy to where it needs to go, either burn it if you're an active person or store it as fat if you're not active. So I think the problem is the quantity. You know, as we said earlier, you find sugar in so many processed foods, and you find high fructose corn syrup in so many processed foods. So by itself, it really shouldn't be considered a demon if it was taken in small quantities. But it's pervasive in our processed foods, and we, as a nation, eat so much processed food.
That's okay. So tablespoon next to tablespoon. Equal.
Biochemically, they look the same.
But it's David Brooks,
I had a question, to be honest, because my understanding is what makes it high fructose corn syrup is it's more than 55% fructose. I understand there's actually a percentage that's used for it to be labeled as such. And it's been artificially, the fructose has been bumped up, and that is part of the reason that it might be problematic.
Right. So with, in the processing, so they're taking corn, which is glucose, and has very little fructose in there, if any, and so it's converted to high fructose corn syrup because now rather than being say 100% glucose, it's now 55% fructose, 45% glucose, which is very similar to what sucrose is.
All right. Well, thank you for the question, Dennis. Important to clear that up. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. You know, Dr. Matheson, we've talked a lot about the connection between sugar and excessive calories in terms of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, the liver. What about cancer? How strong is the link between cancer and sugar?
Yeah, it's fairly strong. You know, again, you can't generalize on this topic, but most cancers are fed by sugar. The reason for this is they express insulin receptors on their cells more than other healthy cells do. So they're hungry for sugar. They're expressing these receptors for insulin, and insulin, again, is the hormone that's a storage hormone and brings sugar into your cells. So yes, particularly breast, prostate, and all gastrointestinal cancers, including colon cancer, pancreatic cancer.
Which is a bad one.
Yes, and they have a lot of insulin receptors on those mutated cancer cells. So it is a problem.
You know what worries me about that? Two things. One is the American diet does have so much sugar in it, as we've heard, because it's in everything. So just first question, I wonder what you think about that. I mean, we're going to see rising rates of cancer because there's so much sugar in our foods?
Well, yeah, you know, cancer is multifactorial, like all our chronic diseases are. So, but sugar is definitely part of the picture, as well as probably environmental toxicity and stress. There are many things. But yes, preventatively, eating a lower refined sugar diet is cancer preventative. And there's definitely research to back that up.
I do worry about people with cancer, though, being blamed. You know, well, you wouldn't have gotten cancer if you hadn't had so much ice cream as a kid. I mean, I know people who have terrific lifestyles and still got cancer. So I worry about blame the victim there.
Oh, yeah, you can't do that. And again, it's multifactorial. You know, it's what you've been exposed to on planet Earth in terms of toxicity. It's your stress level. It's your diet. It's your genetics. You can't blame the victim in that case.
Looks like you want to jump in there, Stephanie.
Well, I just wanted to add to that about the genetics. The genetics loads the gun, and then lifestyle can pull the trigger or not.
Or not.
Or
yeah.
not.
But genetics loads the gun. That's an important point.
At the end of the day, genetics is something that cannot be changed. But the lifestyle can ameliorate a lot of potential problems.
Accent on the word potential.
Potential.
All right, let's take another call. Cynthia's in Milford. Hi, Cynthia. Go ahead.
Yes, my question has to do with type 2 diabetes. Do your guests believe that it can be reversed and actually eliminated without medication through diet and exercise?
Wow. Okay, good question, Cynthia. Thank you. Let's see. Stephanie, you want to tackle that one? And I know you, Dr. Matheson, are a registered diabetes educator as well. But go ahead, Stephanie.
In the early stages, in the pre-diabetic and the early diabetic stages, that's usually when a type 2 diabetic is put on metformin or glucophage to increase their insulin sensitivities. If they have a pretty dramatic lifestyle change in terms of calories in and calories out or exercise, which does increase the tissue sensitivity to insulin, They can reverse it, not completely or maybe permanently sometimes. The problem, as Dr. Matheson had mentioned earlier, was that the pancreas just sends out more and more and more insulin and works harder and harder and harder. In fact, a lot of our second-tier diabetic medications basically flog the pancreas to just produce more insulin. So eventually you will burn it out, and then that's when a lot of the type 2s will have to resort to taking insulin every day.
Yeah,
but
sure.
In the very early days, yes, you can certainly, a great many people can reverse
it. Well, that's good news and a good question, Cynthia. Do you want to jump in real quickly there, Dr. Matheson?
Sure, sure. You know, if you get on it really quickly in the early stages, that's absolutely true. If you do some things to improve your insulin sensitivity, like green tea, for example, does that. Vitamin D does that. And exercise does that. And eating a low glycemic index diet, meaning eating foods that don't digest into sugar very quickly, will improve your insulin sensitivity. So yes, it can be reversed in the early stages. I've seen it happen many times.
Well, and Professor Carey, one last question for you. What do you wish you knew more definitively about the impact of sugar on the body or the brain?
Wow. That's a great question.
I mean, there's so much we know, and we've talked about this hour, but what do you wish you knew more about?
I think the area that I find fascinating is the effects of sugar on the brain. You know, this emerging research that we know that the brain needs glucose in order to keep itself alive, but this emerging research suggesting that particular areas of the brain, particularly those that are involved in light up with addictive behaviors, potentially can also light up with particular diets, combinations of carbohydrates and fats. And I think that's an area to keep an eye on that I would love to see more research in.
Yeah, and one takeaway I've gotten from all of you is that we can say sugar does this or does that to the body, to the digestive system, but each person is so different too, right?
Right.
Professor Carey, that's,
absolutely.
That's what complicates it.
It complicates it very much in moving from doing, say, animal research, you know, where you're looking at laboratory animals that are bred and the controlled under very controlled conditions, and then you move to humans where you've got a whole wide variety of genomes and environments.
Okay,
it's challenging.
What's next on the Science Cafe, David Brooks?
We are going to talk about the science of making roads. How do they make decisions of where a road goes? So now you can show up tomorrow night at Killarney's and blame your commute on a computer model.
Thanks a lot, all of you, for being here. David Brooks, it was good to see you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And also Stephanie Ballantyne, Dr. Burt Matheson, Gail Carey. Thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it.
This feeling too. I just can't believe it's true. Ah, sugar.